Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, August 24th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Kevin McCory, in for Avi Wolfman-Arendt. So, Cherry, I went down memory lane a little bit to prep for today's show, specifically almost 14 years ago, September of 2012. I was a reporter assigned to cover an event with then U.S. Senator Pat Toomey right across the street on Independence Mall. He at the time was criticizing President Obama and pushing for the election of Mitt Romney. The national debt had just hit an all-time high then of $16 trillion, and he told me we were heading towards a debt crisis similar to what was happening in Europe at the time, which was pretty bad. And he said, quote, "When you rack up an unprecedented amount of debt, you can see what happens by looking across the Atlantic. This doesn't end well." Well, fast forward to the present, Cherry. Mm-hmm. We're $40 trillion in debt.
Whoa.
And fiscal debt hawks like Toomey just don't seem to exist anymore. Mm-hmm. So today on the show, how did we get here? Why does it matter to you and I? Why hasn't the sky fallen already? And what should we do next?
Yeah, I think about $40 trillion. I can't even wrap my head around what that actually means. Hopefully we'll get a chance to do that today.
Yeah. Yeah, looking forward to this conversation. We've got some great guests in the studio who can break it all down for us. And we're hoping that we hear from our audience today. Mm-hmm. Are you concerned about the national debt? Does $40 trillion scare you? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. If you're watching along on YouTube or Facebook, leave your comment in the live chat.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you because, you know, we've heard, like you said, you know, years ago, 2012, people were talking about $16 trillion as being huge. We're at $40 trillion. And I know my math sometimes is off, but that's more than double.
That's right.
Well,
Cherry.
Over double.
That's right.
Okay. So, yeah. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And we have our trio of local news stories. Immigration Custom Enforcement, a.k.a. ICE, is spending an estimated $17 million with businesses in the Philadelphia region. One of the biggest contracts is with a Montgomery County-based firearms manufacturer. That's according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Gazelle Automatics, they specialize in selling high-grade, semi-automatic AR-15-type weapons and parts to military, law enforcement, and to consumers. And the company has a $9.1 million contract with ICE. It began back in September of last year. It's unclear where the equipment purchase is being used, but the Inquirer reports that the founder has donated to Republicans in Pennsylvania, including the Senator Dave McCormick. And while this is not the company's first federal contract, it is its most significant to date. The Inquirer reached out to the company, and of course, they got no response in their request for a comment. But under the second Trump administration, ICE and U.S. Border Patrol has increased spending on firearms, Kevin, and this has led to an outcry by some Democrats who have said that the agencies have become a militarized force with little oversight or accountability. And for its part, the Department of Homeland Security has pushed back on the $17 million number when it comes to contracts in the region. It says this conflates ICE contracts with federal spending in the area. And I should mention that there are a couple of other companies with pretty significant contracts in our region. We have a $4.1 million contract with Attrivos-based data systems analyst. That's a defense IT and consulting company. There's also a $3.1 million contract with Dentrust Dental International in Pipersville. It's a mobile healthcare company. So they're not just doing firearms, but they have a whole bunch of different types of things that they're using federal contracts to spend money in our region.
Yeah, interesting story there by the Inquirer. With these private businesses, we've seen, you know, I think when there's contracts on the line that require like, you know, government officials to weigh in, county officials, state officials, that's where it seems like some of the pushback to the ICE contracts has been more politically successful. Mm-hmm. Kind of unclear to me, you know, what if people care too much about these private businesses and what that would mean. But maybe they do, and maybe there'll be some sort of a pressure campaign on them. But interesting to see the details nonetheless.
Yeah.
Story number two, Cherry. Yeah. The number of people using food stamps in Pennsylvania has fallen by 11%.
Wow.
And state officials say about half of that decline can be attributed to the new eligibility rules in the federal One Big Beautiful Bill. Mm. So you remember that law passed last summer. It implemented these changes to, you know, SNAP, food stamps that included new work requirements. Can't get that word out. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Limited immigrants eligibility and required some more paperwork to sign up or renew benefits. And according to the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, it works out to about 100,000 people across Pennsylvania whose benefits were cut because of those new rules. Really nice reporting here by the Pennsylvania Capital Star. They ran down all the data and they got comment from the feds, who did dispute the Pennsylvania numbers, and they said, quote, the number of individuals receiving benefits is constantly changing and is not representative of one policy. For example, multiple states have seen declines far before the enactment of the bill. But then you talk to food banks across the state, and they're saying they're feeling increased demand in large part because of these SNAP changes, but also just higher cost of living that we've all been dealing with, Cherry. And the Capital Star did speak with leaders at the Philadelphia-based Share Food Program, which said it saw a direct correlation to SNAP benefits being cut and a surge in demand at the food bank.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of talk that this all is going to get worse in January, right, when new Medicaid eligibility rules go into effect. But I did run into the leader of a local food bank recently, and she told me they get a lot of donated food, but they also buy a lot of food, and food costs have gone up, right, in part because of tariffs, higher gas and transportation costs. And of course, you know, harsher weather has impacted crops, right? So the funds don't go as far as they once did. And there's all this increased demand as well. So there's this perfect storm. And like I said, it's expected to get worse. And one of the things we never talk about is grocery stores. Mm. A lot of grocery stores actually depend on all the folks with SNAP benefits. Mm-hmm. That keeps the economy going. And then they're going to be losing money probably a lot more in January. And I should also mention that nationally, Arizona has been considered this canary in a coal mine. Mm. They've lost more than 400,000 people off the SNAP rolls because they were the quickest state to implement the Big Beautiful Bill changes already. And they've been hit pretty hard there.
Interesting. All right. Story number three, Cherry.
Yeah. The nation's first selfie happened right here in Philadelphia. Yeah, we get to pop our collars and claim that. It was 1839 when a young Philadelphia inventor named Robert Cornelius turned the camera on himself. He was trained in silver painting and metalwork. He had a job working for his father's lamp making business, and he became interested in photography when his friend and fellow inventor, Joseph Paxton, who is believed, by the way, to have taken the oldest photograph right here in Philly, Joseph asked him to create a daguerreotype, right? That was a French photographic device that made more detailed and longer lasting images than ever before. Well, Cornelius set up this contraption outside his parents' shop, and he snapped the shot. And get this, he had to stand there perfectly still for anywhere from 5 to 15 minutes. It's unclear how long. And it was dangerous because he used chemicals like bromine and mercury on those metal plates. And
he looked good.
He did all that, and bam, look at him. Look at that haircut. Look at that side eye. Look at that pop collar with the black jacket. He looks ageless and timeless in this photo. And and so this is the very first selfie. It held up pretty good for all those years. And shout out to Billy Penn for this wonderful story. All of this is part of the Philadelphia Historic District's 52 Weeks of First. They hosted a selfie gathering at Franklin Square this past Saturday. But Kevin, I've taken probably thousands of selfies over the past decade. You know what I mean?
Right.
You take a couple here, there, and some of them don't look right, whatever. So you do another 10 or a dozen. And I just, you know, we owe this all to Mr. Cornelius. How many selfies do you think you've taken?
A controversial take here, Cherry. I think women can take selfies. Grown man taking a selfie. Women can. Grown man taking a selfie is cringe.
You think so?
I'd like to take them with the kids. I've taken them before, just of myself. Every single time I do, I have this pit of something in my stomach. Like, what am I doing?
But people,
grown man taking a picture of himself?
But people take selfies with each other.
Right. Like, I like that.
And so those count.
Okay.
Those count because people don't like the selfies better than they do the regular pictures because people blink when they take the picture. You know what I mean?
I guess so.
And some people don't know how to take pictures, so we'd rather
right. I like it with the family. Here, I'm also pro get somebody to take your picture for you. I like that. I like a little interaction with somebody walking by and you say, "Oh, sir, can I take a picture?" The great thing is when you both want to get one and you take it for them and they take it for you. I like that.
The problem is I'm really good at taking pictures. And then other people not good. And so I get a bad picture. So I do selfie.
That's true.
But thank you.
If I took your picture, I would do a good job.
I know you would. You're a professional. And so we're going to be talking to a couple of professionals on the other side of this break. We're going to be talking about the $40 trillion in debt that America is in. Are you concerned about it? 888-477-9499. This is Studio 2. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Most Americans have debt of some kind, credit card debt, student loans, a mortgage. The government can be no different. Throughout our history, America has borrowed for reasons including stimulating the economy, fighting wars, and paying for benefits.
But recently, we've racked up quite a tab. Tax cuts have coincided with major spending on war, pandemic relief, and social safety nets for our aging population. And now, the U.S. national debt is over $40 trillion. That's with a T, dollars. And lenders are taking notice.
Yeah, economists say that if things don't change, there's a chance we could be headed towards a debt spiral. So how did we get here, and what does soaring national debt mean for regular Americans?
Yeah, and to help us unpack it all, we're joined by some very smart people. For two decades, Brendan Greeley was a journalist covering economics and monetary policy. Now he is a contributing editor at Financial Times and an economic historian. His new book is The Almighty Dollar, 500 Years of the World's Most Powerful Money. Welcome to the show, Brendan. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Let me weigh in on the most important issue of the day, which is what you were talking about before the break. Are men allowed to take selfies? I'm with Kevin. I take selfies with my children, but never alone.
I love it. I love it, Brendan. Thank you.
I also cringe. I also feel embarrassed directing the camera at myself.
Oh,
and in
my.
Fact, what I do is please.
With us,
he has a take. Hot take.
Thank you for the hot takes, Brendan. And with us in studio is friend of the show, Patrick Harker, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, professor at the Wharton School. Welcome back, Patrick.
Yeah, I don't take many selfies, so it's okay. It's,
yeah. Thanks for being here, Brendan. And of course, as always, Patrick, thanks for being here. And as always, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Are you concerned about the national debt? Does that $40 trillion number scare you at all? We'd love to hear your thoughts. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube streamers, you can put your comments in the live chat.
So, Patrick, let's start with you. Last time we had a surplus in this country was 2001. Mm-hmm. I laid out at the top of the program this interaction I had with Senator Pat Toomey in 2012 when the debt was $16 trillion. Now, last week, we hit $40. Mm-hmm. Could you just walk us through that history of the past 25 years and how we got to where we are?
So a lot of it was due to the dot-com boom. We were able to grow a lot, right? So growth is part of the solution. Mm-hmm. I mean, you cannot just tax your way out of this. You have to also have growth. You need a package of things to do. So, of course, then we had 2008, and that all came unraveled. And basically, it really comes down to we've decided to spend more than we bring in. Just to put this in perspective, the federal government spends $4 billion every 16 hours.
Right.
Right? So this is a massive amount of expenditure. Yes, we're at war, but we're doing this even before the war with Iran. And if you peel back the onion, right, what matters is in the federal budget, it's really just three things. 85% of the federal budget is three things: entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, now interest on the debt, mm-hmm. number two, mm-hmm. and defense. You cannot, you, those could have killed the entire rest of the federal government. We'd still run deficits. The key is we've got to deal with health care. If you don't deal with health care, you can't solve this problem.
But just to unpack the layers a little bit there further. So obviously we had the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. We had the financial crisis that you're talking about. At the same time, we've been reducing the tax burden on Americans through a series of tax cuts. And then, like you're saying, now we have this issue where the older population is going on Social Security at a rate that hasn't existed before, and you have fewer people paying into it. And we're looking at this, you know, kind of a inverse baby boom thing happening, which might give us nightmares for the farther future. Anything more to add to that, Patrick?
I mean, what are we going to do, right? There are answers to this, and we can get into that.
Yeah.
There are things we can do, but we have to recognize we've got to do something. I mean, this is accelerating. What bothers me, and I think what bothers most economists, is not that we hit $40 trillion. It's how fast we hit it, right? And it's accelerating. Yes, there's a war in Iran, but that's not the only reason. That's not the main reason. Nobody's talking about this. You think about Senator Toomey. He was one of the last ones to talk about this. Nobody on the Hill's talking about this. They're being forced right now to talk about Social Security, because that's coming due. That bill's coming due in 6 years.
Yeah. So, Brendan, I want to bring you in the conversation because people have been hearing politicians scream about the national debt for decades. I mean, Kevin laid out, 14 years ago, this was a conversation that was being had. And somehow the lights are still on, right? And so I want you to sort of like explain, why should somebody listening to us right now care that we have crossed this $40 trillion mark? And I want to sort of say that because most people can't even understand what $1 trillion is, let alone $40 trillion.
I think it's important to know that we, and when I say we, I mean people like me who talk to economists regularly, economists, policymakers, we don't know how this ends. There's this sense when you talk to economists, they're very serious, sober people who deal with numbers, that we can pinpoint the moment at which this becomes a problem. Mm-hmm. We can't. So that's a real issue. We just don't know. How much more run rate do we have on this? And the answer is, let's not find out. I also think, though, I agree with everything Patrick said. I think it's important to talk about how we politically gave ourselves permission to run up debts in America, because that wasn't always the case. Mm-hmm. So in the mid-90s, there was a scare in America over what we used to call bond vigilantes. These were investors who we believed would raise the price of borrowing for America if our debt-to-GDP ratio got too high. There was a moment in the mid-90s, 1994, where the 10-year Treasury, the interest rate was at 7.2%. And that was scary for people. But just to give us a sense of perspective, right now, debt to GDP, sort of debt as a ratio of our of what we produce every year, is at 122%. At that point, it was at 65%. Mm-hmm. Right, so there was this.
So we had a scare at 65, and now we're
Yeah, we had a scare at 65, and when you look at debt to GDP, it actually dropped. Part of that is exactly what Patrick said, growth, this incredible expansion in investment, a lot of it in computer equipment during the dot-com boom. The other thing that happened was there was bipartisan legislation to bring down the deficit, to get us to a point of surplus by 2001. It's a really interesting moment in American sort of political or economic history. Early January, right after George W. Bush has been sworn in, 2001.
Yeah, yeah.
Alan Greenspan testifies in Congress, and they ask him, are you okay with these tax cuts? And he says it's a really interesting thing, which is, well, I don't know whether the tax cuts will work or not, but I think it's important that America not go into surplus, because as the chairman of the Fed, it makes my job more difficult. And it also means that the United States would then be investing in things, and I'm not sure whether we want the United States deciding what it invests in. And so at the time, that was a big deal. Alan Greenspan saying, I'm okay with the Republican tax cuts. Now, I don't want to lay all this at the feet of the Republicans. What I'm interested in is how we gave ourselves permission to borrow and borrow and borrow.
And Patrick, I'd love to get your thoughts on in response to Brendan's thought, to what Brendan just said, because you've been with the Fed. I mean, this idea that America is okay with borrowing, You know, it feels like we've had politicians, not just on the Republican side, but both sides of the aisle, being very mindful of our spending, making sure we don't go into deep debt. How do we get to a place, just psychologically even, where it just became okay and it's not even something that we even talk about?
We're not dancing alone. Let's first. Yeah. The rest of the world is in the same situation. Mm-hmm. And so everybody, it's a kind of collective view that somehow we just let this go. Crisis after crisis hit us. We kept spending and we never pulled back. We keep growing things, but we never pull them back. I mean, that's really the issue. So I think that when you look at the history of this, mm-hmm. you know, actually, if you look at way back when, on the corner of 3rd and Chestnut Street, the first bank of the United States was there because Hamilton wanted to repay the debts of the United States. Mm. We are so far away from that now. But Brendan made a really important point. It's not about the $40 trillion. It's $40 trillion relative to the size of the economy. It's the size of the debt relative to GDP. And that number, as he said, is 120%. And yes, Brendan, economists try to pick a number when they think we've reached the point of no return. I live with a bunch of economists, particularly a fellow named Kent Smetters in the Penn Wharton budget model. And you know, they have a report out that when you hit about 210%, we're not going to be able to recover without really
austerity.
Severe consequences. And that all hinges on when that happens, all hinges on your estimate of healthcare productivity. If you think we're going to get more productive, then it's going to be pushed out to like 2055. If you think we're basically going to have the same productivity we have today, we're looking at 2045, which seems like a long time from now, but it isn't.
Yeah, less than 20 years. Yeah.
Brendan, just to try to tie it back to like why average people should care, is there something that's happening right now that is hurting regular Americans because the debt's at $40 trillion? What can you say to that?
I think a lot of the American economy runs on federal debt. I think it's hard for us to understand how much would change if we suddenly stopped borrowing. And I think one of the reasons we're having this conversation now is that $40 trillion is a big, round, scary number. But Patrick's right. We have to measure it relative to the size of the economy. But 125% is also a significant number. It's not the highest number ever recorded in the world, but it seems like a big deal. The other number we have to pay attention to is the interest cost that the United States pays. To borrow. And for a long time, you know, for the last 20 years, there haven't been any consequences for borrowing. You know, it used to be when America engaged in war, there had to be a big national conversation about how we pay for it. World War I, World War II, you know, there was these big national drives involving Hollywood stars and country singers and Boy Scouts, you know, to sell Liberty bonds and borrow from the American public to help keep down inflation during the war. They had to, you know, the Federal Reserve in the Second World War had to get behind the effort to make sure that the war was affordable. These were big logistical lifts to pay for war. In the 2000s, when we went to war in Afghanistan and Iraq, there was no big public discussion about how we were going to pay for it. We just did. So we didn't pay any consequences in interest costs. And I think right now what's happening is for the last 3 or 4 years and increasingly over the last 6 months, we've seen interest rates on the federal debt rise. That's scary because it suddenly looks like for some reason, and there are a couple of different reasons why, we're paying a price for all this debt.
Does that correlate to the interest rates that, like, if I want to take out a car loan, Patrick, I'm going to pay higher interest rates now because the debt's at $40 trillion?
Yeah, because what you're seeing is the long end of the yield curve, as economists and financiers call it, whether it's 10-year bonds or 30-year bonds, that would be your mortgage, they are going up. And it's being caused for a couple of reasons. One is the bond vigilantes. They're getting nervous about the U.S. in terms of its – look, this is a very simple supply and demand question, right? What's the price of a bond? Well, what are you willing to pay for it? It's a matter of supply and demand, right? If nobody wants to buy the bond, I can get it cheap, which means the interest rates are really high. Mm-hmm. If everybody wants it, then it's going to be expensive and the interest rates are going to be low, right? And so that's basic bond 101. And what's happening right now is some of the rest of the world is backing off a little bit in terms of purchasing treasuries. Others are getting a little nervous. You're starting to see even some central banks loading up a little bit more on gold. And not so much on treasuries. It's not a crisis, but you're seeing it on the margin. And so it's a question of confidence. It's fundamentally a question of confidence. If I give you this money, am I going to get the money back and not lose money? Right? Yeah. It's a very basic dynamic. And what's happening right now is two things. One is those bond vigilantes are out there getting nervous. Second, and this is unprecedented, in economics, we often talk about the government borrowing crowding out private sector borrowing. So if the government borrows so much, we're seeing the opposite right now. Because of this AI build-out, the AI guys are squeezing out the government borrowing. More people want to invest in the AI stuff than they do in treasuries.
So interesting. By the way, we'd love to hear from you. Our question of the day, are you concerned about the national debt? Does that $40 trillion number scare you? We'd love to hear your thoughts. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And on Facebook and YouTube, you can put your comments in the chat. Let me read a couple comments. You know, a commenter on Facebook says, no, they're not worried at all. That was a simple response. Gregory on Facebook says, it's just a number for most Americans. They can't fathom what $1 trillion is, let alone 40 trillion. Luann from Glenside says, the biggest concern should be the status of the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world. I just read the book, The New World Order by Ray Dalio. History shows us what happens to other nations, like the empires of history, when they lose the status of reserve currency. If we lose our status, that's a bad deal for us. Let's bring in a caller. We have Tiffany from Philly on the line. Tiffany, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hey, yeah, I'd love to hear, like, if there is a really big economic crisis or recession or shock as a result of the federal debt at some point, like, what does that look like? And then in the long term, like, how might that resolve? Like, what would the impacts on the stock market and or ETFs be? And I know there was a bond crisis in the UK that was an issue. And so I'm just wondering, like, what's worst case scenario and what comes after?
Yeah, thank you so much, Tiffany. Patrick, you sort of talked about the folks getting a little nervous. You know, play this out. Play out a scenario for us. What would happen where you would start getting like, oh, my gosh, this debt is gotten out of control and it is a crisis.
So won't be any one thing. Mm-hmm. Right. It's always a combination of things that tend to tip the economy into recession, into a crisis, or the stock market. And so it's not only the debt issue, but it's also people getting a little nervous about the AI investment. I mean, are you going to get your money back there, too? Because the Chinese are building out a much cheaper version of these AI models. So there's a general nervousness in the market that's starting to show up occasionally. That's why we see all this volatility day to day. All those things combined can really drive both the stock market and the economy into recession. And here's the problem, right? When that happens, what's the typical response? Well, the Fed responds by lowering interest rates. But then the fiscal side of the house puts in programs to support the economy like we did during the pandemic, right? We put
spending more.
We put programs to lend small businesses and so forth. Well, what if there's no money to lend? What if we've just tapped out the market because we borrowed so much? Mm-hmm. That's the fear, that this is the crowding out effect, that if a next crisis happens, we may not have any dry powder, as they say, to be able to put toward it.
So what does that worst case scenario really feel like for a person like me or you? Like, how do we feel?
So if we
go
into recession,
what does the world look like?
Yeah, so we go into recession, you know, you lose your job. Yeah, some people lose their houses, their cars. I mean, it could be hopefully a mild recession. There's going to be a market correction. There's always a market correction.
Yeah.
But this is adding on to that. The debt issue is adding on to that market correction. We don't know when or it'll happen. It will happen at some point. Whether it's shallow or deep depends on how much of that dry powder we have to respond.
And I have to say, something that stood out to me is something you said, Patrick, and Brendan, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. You know, just the high cost of servicing this debt. You know, the three big buckets you talked about, you said, look, we're paying for, you know, Social Security, health care, we're paying for military, and then we're also paying for the debt service. And this debt service is so expensive. And so I just wonder, Brendan, your thoughts on that, because the more we borrow, the more expensive it is, given all these folks that Patrick talked about, as they get nervous and less people want to take on the debt. Just your thoughts as this price to even service this debt keeps growing year over year over year.
Yeah, absolutely. There is one way in which the federal budget is a lot like the household budget, which is that most of us tend to look at our monthly costs. You know, when you look at ads for cars, car financing, what they're really selling you is your monthly payment, because that's how most of us do our mental accounting. There's a kind of mental accounting that happens with the debt, which is not like what's going to happen eventually. But in politics, it's what are we paying right now? So I think as the price rises, you're actually going to see some real urgency. There's a lot of theater in Washington around the debt. People like to talk about it. It's very difficult to get anyone to actually care about it. You know, Kevin remembers this from covering the Hill. I also covered the Hill around the same time. There's a lot of breathless talk about what we're going to do about the deficit and a whole lot of nothing done about it. This is a very old story. So I think as the price of it actually raises, to your point, Cherry, it's possible that as citizens begin, or not as citizens, but rather as Washington begins to see those monthly costs go up, that might create some urgency. I also think, just to follow on to what Patrick said about what a recession would look like, if that recession were triggered by a drop in the value of a treasury or a rise in the price that the United States has to pay to borrow money, it is very difficult to explain just how deeply intertwined treasuries are, American debt, into the plumbing of absolutely every financial transaction and investment portfolio in the world. So whatever it is you have in savings, a 401k, a defined benefit pension, they're resting a little bit on treasuries or possibly a lot on treasuries. And if the value of that drops, that's a problem for everyone.
So all of us with 401ks, right.
So just to speak to the comment we got from the listener, we've been asking people, like, are you concerned? Do you care? And the person just wrote in, no, right? Maybe it's just because they've heard this story so many times that they feel like I won't get fooled again to get myself all worked up.
Politicians haven't had to care for a long time.
Why is this moment different?
All right, so let's look at one slice of the issue, Social Security. The trust fund runs out of money in 6 years. That's right.
I had to take a swallow there.
That's 22% of the benefit that somebody gets. So when you get your Social Security check, 78% is coming out of payroll taxes that we're paying for the retirees. The other 22 out of the trust fund. When it runs out of money, that 22%, 22% is gone. That means an automatic reduction of 20 to 22% in Social Security benefits to every retired American.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
That will get your attention. And that is 6 years away, roughly. We've got to solve that problem. And so that is just really the beginning of this discussion. I think, by the way, why Americans should care about this, we're spending over $1 trillion a year on interest.
Yeah, that part. Yeah.
What could we do as a society with $1 trillion that we're not spending on interest? A lot.
Yeah.
And that should concern everybody that we're, instead of that. Now, that money circulates back into the economy, let's be clear, because it goes into your 401k and so forth. So it's not as though it's a full trillion. But there's money there that we could use for something else.
Could you speak to a little bit, like, why do you think the politics on this became so almost, they don't matter? It's like if there's a Democrat or a Republican running things, the debt just keeps going up.
Yeah,
it's
so
like there's no political answer here.
So I got this question a lot. Social Security will be fixed because senior citizens vote and politicians want to get reelected, right?
Yeah.
So that will get fixed. This, you just keep kicking the can down the road. Because, look, the numbers I gave you, 2045. We thought that was close. They don't think it's close. So why would they want to go solve it? I think the only way you address this issue, the one place in Congress that works pretty well in a bipartisan way is a base realignment commission.
Yeah.
Why? Because they decide how they have to reapportion military bases. Mm-hmm. And then it's a single up or down vote. They can't amend it. We had Bowles Simpson and other approaches to try to deal with deficits and debts.
Right.
What I think they need to do, and we citizens need to force them to do, is have a base realignment kind of idea. Once these commissions come up with ideas, it's up or down, no amendments.
Yeah, and by the way, I want to bring in a caller because we're about to go to a break in just a minute. And I think this caller will help us tee up the conversation on the other side of the break. We have Chris from Devon on the line. Chris, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
A couple of suggestions how we could solve the problem. The first one is a 10% cut on all government programs across the board. But more importantly, the real problem here is retirement age. The retirement age has not changed in 50, 60 years. You have people who used to die at around 55 or 60. They're living to be 90 years old. Now, they're not going to want to retire early or keep working. But if you give them an incentive to keep working, then they will. For instance, one idea is to give them, if they agree to work an extra 3 years beyond their retirement age, they get a 50% cut in their federal tax. If they agree to work 5 or 10 years, then they get they have to pay no federal taxes.
And Chris, I got to stop you there because we got to go to break. But Chris has a lot of ideas, and so on the other side of the break, we're going to talk about how do we tackle $40 trillion in national debt, and knowing that next year it'll probably be an even bigger number. Are you concerned about the national debt? Does that $40 trillion number scare you? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We have more of this conversation, lots of comments from our listeners. This is Studio 2. We'll be right back after the break. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory and Faravi Wolfman Aaron. Today on the show, we're talking about why America is $40 trillion in debt and what it means for the country and your wallet. Joining us this hour is Patrick Harker, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia and professor at the Wharton School. We're also joined by Brendan Creeley, contributing editor at the Financial Times and author of the new book, The Almighty Dollar, 500 Years of the World's Most Powerful Money.
Yeah, and as always, we'd love to hear from you. Are you concerned about the national debt? Does $40 trillion, does that number scare you? We'd love to hear your thoughts. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can leave your comments in the chat. And Brendan, we wanted to just give you a moment to kind of respond to our caller, Chris, who, you know, was sort of coming up with ideas to deal with a big chunk of what our budget deals with, on the federal budget deals with, which is Social Security. And just wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, part of the challenge that we're looking at in the future is the very likely possibility of having to contribute, you know, directly from the federal debt into the Social Security fund to make sure that people get their benefits. I agree with him. There's going to have to be some negotiation around that. But as part of that conversation, I feel like one thing we haven't really talked about at all yet today is taxes.
Yeah.
Another proposal to make sure that Social Security is safe for another several decades, at the very least, is to raise the cap on the amount of your income that actually is taxed for Social Security. That to me is part of a broader question. Mm-hmm. When we look at how we got from being in surplus in 2001, or rather being on a yearly basis and being headed towards debt-free status in 2009, that was where we were headed in 2001. There are a lot of contributors to that. And when you look at, I pulled this up because I've seen this a couple times over the last 2 decades. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget actually sort of looks through what contributed to where we are now. And a lot of it is what we've already talked about. Wars, recessions, these are things that have to be paid for. But 37% of how we got here is tax cuts since 2001. Now, right. We cannot unfight those wars and we cannot unemergency those emergencies, but we can take a look at the tax cuts, and that's going to become important to the people listening right now, because it's entirely possible that if we take this seriously, people's taxes are going to go back up, because we cannot solve this problem by hitting a few billionaires. It has to be a broad increase in some things that we take for granted, like being able to deduct our mortgage interest from taxes. There's a lot of things that a lot of people listening enjoy that don't really have any economic benefit. They're just kind of goodies that get handed out. And this, I like the base realignment approach that Patrick is suggesting, but it's going to take a hard look at that, and it's going to affect all of us. There's weird trick to
Patrick,
this.
I'm curious. I think there's a view maybe in the Trump administration right now that the tax conversation is not needed. We can grow our way out of this just simply through economic growth. You disagree with that. Why?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, I'll lean on my buddies at Wharton. They've done an analysis, careful analysis of this. There are things you can do, but it's a package. There's no one thing, right? It's a package of things. It's a package of closing tax loopholes, other taxes, dealing with health care, dealing with Social Security, and having some pro-growth strategy. That's all part of it. And a big part of the growth picture, which is outside of what we're talking about so far, there's one basic rule of economics. Mm-hmm. If you want more output, if you want to grow, you either get more output out of each person and or machine, or you get more machines or people, right? And we are going south on people. Our birth rate is too low. We're 1.6. We've flatlined to gone negative on immigration. This can only dig the hole deeper when it comes to the situation we're in.
And maybe you can address Nancy from Lawrence Hill's question. She says, I'm wondering how the cuts to the IRS and our immigration policy have impacted the nation's debt. Hope your guests can address these. And Patrick, just to follow up. So if people can really see and explain, like when you have immigration policies like we have now, how does that cause the debt to grow?
Well, it's too early because this all just came in, but it
causes us not to grow.
But going forward, unless we get this massive productivity increase from AI, which we'll get a productivity increase from AI, but it's got to be above trend to be able to fill in for the people that we lose. And by the way, the IRS thing, this is one of my bugaboos. Mm-hmm. Imagine you're a company and you're in trouble. Who are the last people you lay off? The accounts receivable department. The people bringing in the money, right? What do? We starve the people who are bringing in the money.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about who are we borrowing from, and how does this matter, and how does this connect to everything else? Because one of our listeners said, Connie from Warminster asked, I'd like to know what percentage of the national debt we owe to China. Like, who are we borrowing from? How does this affect the rest of us and our global economy? And I don't know, Brendan, if you want to jump in here.
Yeah, not as much as you would think. A small and shrinking percentage of our debt is held abroad for a lot of reasons. As Patrick alluded to earlier, foreign central banks are diversifying their portfolios. They don't just hold American debt. Used to be that, you know, the only secure investment you had was an American treasury. There are others now, and they're looking at holding other things, including gold. That's part of it. Another thing that, you know, that's been going on that's sort of difficult to explain but really important is that the goal of a treasury as an investor was to have, in addition to your risky investments, some non-risky investments. An increasing percentage of our debt is being held by hedge funds right now that are doing a very complicated trade, too complicated to explain on the radio, but they're borrowing a lot of money, short-term loans, to buy a lot of treasuries and do a really complicated trade to eke out just like teeny tiny margins that if you borrow a lot of money become huge profits. And so we used to have a lot of people who wanted secure investments holding treasuries, who wanted to hold on to them for a long time. And now, increasingly, we have a small number of people who look at treasuries as a very speculative investment and a complex trade that they're funding with borrowed money. So I disagree with your caller, or rather, I think I can reassure your caller. I don't think that the problem is that our debt is held by foreigners.
Okay.
I think the problem is that increasingly our debt is held by very flighty investors who might get into trouble if suddenly the value of American debt were to drop.
So we're talking about solutions here, and you know, you might have an idea, but if we get down to like, okay, what's actually going to pass politically, and how's this actually going to work out? I'm just, you know, forecasting into the future a little bit, and I think if, say, a Democrat is elected president in 2028, they're going to want to increase all these programs that they're going to cost more money, and maybe if a Republican gets elected, they're going to want to cut taxes further. Yep. There doesn't seem to be political appetite for any sort of shared sacrifice or going backwards or buckling down. How do you really think this is going to play out politically?
So I think the private sector, particularly the bond market and those bond vigilantes, will discipline the market eventually, because they'll just say...
And what does that mean, discipline the
they'll
market?
They'll just start selling bonds and driving interest rates up. And they're saying, we don't trust these anymore. You guys are out of control. And we've seen this in other countries, right, who have gotten into significant trouble. I mean, where we've had to intervene in some cases to try to stabilize their economies. That's what it means when the market says, we've had enough. Mm-hmm. Now, there are little signs of it now, and you see it. One place you see it, the Fed, on behalf of the Treasury, conducts the Treasury auction. So these bonds are auctioned off every month, right? There's literally an auction. And some of those auctions, not so many people showed up. I mean, they still got rid of what they weren't putting out in the market, but it was thinly traded. Those early signs are warning signs.
And when that happens, you think, I guess, whoever is politically in power, they'll pull a different lever.
Yeah.
Like one would pull the, you know, let's reverse the tax cuts lever maybe, and the other will pull the let's cut the benefits lever.
Yeah, and so, you know, you look at what's going on right now. There's a lever being pulled right now by Secretary Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, to try to stop. The largest holder of treasuries outside the U.S. is Japan.
Yeah.
$1 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to stop them from selling those. That is what it all comes down to,
yeah.
Because that just exacerbates the problem we have.
And so Brandon on Facebook says, this is very concerning. The U.S. cannot afford to pay $40 trillion in debt, take on multiple foreign wars, and give the wealthiest tax breaks. It has devalued the dollar, creating fractures in the global monetary system. People won't be concerned until their 401ks lose 40% or more, mortgage rates and foreclosures skyrocket. And I wonder your thoughts. I mean, we're coming up on the midterms. People talking about affordability. We got 2028 just in the horizon. And I just think, how do you see this becoming a priority? Because I remember, you know, at one point, especially during the Obama administration, you know, debt was an issue. People felt the recession, you know, the economic downturn.
Yeah.
And getting this together was a priority. Do you see that happening anytime soon, Brendan, politically, that this $40 trillion debt being something that is in the mind of every American?
I don't. And I don't want to put words in Patrick's mouth, but what I heard just there was nothing's going to happen until there is a crisis. Congress doesn't tend to act unless it's forced to. And what's going to force it to act is a spike in the rates that the United States Treasury pays to borrow money. And we're seeing the beginnings of it, which is one of the reasons why we're having this conversation. But it would have to continue going up. We'd have to see those borrowing costs spike. That would drive politicians to come up with an answer. One of the things that I worry about is that it's in the past. So neither party has funded emergency rescues or war. But in general, over the last 20 years, Republicans have tended to not pay for tax cuts. Democrats have tended to come up with ways to pay for new programs. There are lots of exceptions to that, but that's generally true. One of the things that worries me a little bit is that we're seeing in the Democratic Party a shift, which is you guys didn't pay for, meaning the Republicans never paid for your tax cuts and it was fine. Why have we been worried this whole time? Why do we have to be the responsible adults? So right at the moment at which we may actually have to think about the debt and make some real structural shifts that will cause some pain to average Americans, Democrats are saying, like, we're tired of being the adults and we're not going to pay for things.
So somebody
either.
Gets and elected and says, we're going to do Medicare for all and don't ask me how I'm going to pay for it. And you think that that would be a bad thing, Brendan?
I think we've run out of room to not pay for things.
Yeah. So I want to keep it really simple here.
Yeah.
We're talking about the debt, the deficit, $40 trillion. You know, it seems daunting. Let's focus on the things that really matter, right? The way I think we can get political traction. Social Security is one of those. Again, these are the big three: entitlements, interest, defense. The rest, yeah, it matters, but you got to solve those three. And the second one is derivative of borrowing too much, right? So we've got to either solve defense, but really entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Social Security has to be solved, and I think it will be solved. The key issue to deal with the deficit is we've got to get around to actually a healthcare system that works. And this is where I have some optimism.
Mm.
The vast majority of Americans do not like the system we have. They just don't like the system we have. Most Americans don't like their health insurer. They may like their doctor, but they don't like all. I think there's room in there to actually try to do something real. But it's going to take some real political leadership in this country to pull it off.
And we only have 2 minutes left. And so I got to ask you both this question. Fast forward 10 years from now, what would it look like if we failed to deal with this issue? And kind of draw the picture to sort of make the argument as to why we need to start dealing with this. And Patrick, and then of course, Brendan, I'd love for you to close it out.
I mean, that number, the $1 trillion, keeps creeping up, and it crowds out every other thing the federal government can do. So don't think there's going to be a lot of new investment from the federal government. There's not going to be any because we're not going to be
able to. And what does that mean for us, regular folks?
We're not going to be able to fix the roads. We're not going to be able to invest in new technologies that'll keep the America at the leadership at the forefront. That's what it fundamentally means.
Yeah. And your thoughts, Brendan?
I think in addition to what Patrick just said, there are some privileges that we've enjoyed as Americans for a while that we've forgotten about because we just take them for granted. The status of the dollar is one of them. And if it comes to pass that treasuries become less valuable than they are now significantly, we could see the status of the global dollar eroded. And what that would mean is all of the things that we import, a lot of things that we enjoy on a daily basis, would become much more expensive. So if this comes to pass, this thing that we're worried about, it hasn't happened yet, but if it happens, a lot of things are going to become more expensive. And I don't think that we even think about that privilege that we enjoy with the status of the dollar that could be in danger.
All right, well, we have to leave it there. That was the voice of Brendan Greeley. He's contributing editor at the Financial Times and author of the new book, The Almighty Dollar, 500 Years of the World's Most Powerful Money. Thanks so much for joining us on the show today, Brendan. And thank you. With us in studio was Patrick Harker. He's the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia and professor at the Wharton School. Great to have you, as always, Patrick.
Thank you.
Charity. Yeah.
And thank you, of course. Sorry, Mike from Lansdowne, that we did not get to you. I know you were on the line. Please keep listening and call back another day. And, of course, thank you to everybody who wrote in or called in today. And we couldn't do any of what we do without our producers. So thank you to Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Ben Abrams. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory. Thanks for joining us.